Welcome to the Mentoring Minute podcast. My name is Michael Jantz, and I'm with the Alberta Mentoring Partnership. Thanks again for tuning into our podcast, and we encourage you to subscribe to the channel if you aren't already, and please tell a friend, encourage them to subscribe. Today's episode is a special deep dive into youth resiliency with the Brock Healthy Youth Project. We're joined in webinar with Jane Morish, who's the Knowledge Mobilization Officer at Brock University, the Center for Lifespan Development and Research. We explore the role that mentoring has as a protective factor in support of better outcomes for vulnerable youth. It was a really interesting podcast, and stay tuned, not just for the information, but for the questions afterwards. We go into questions about adolescence, about sleep, about the sensitive periods that as adolescents are in and how they're at more risk. We talk about the influence of peers, parents, mentors, caring adults. It's a fascinating study that they're undertaking. We're also going to link you to some fantastic infographics of their findings. Really easy, accessible, and fun information. So thank you again to Jane. We'd love to have you hear your feedback on this podcast. Send us an email at mentor.support@albertamentors.ca. And finally, if you haven't already, registration is open for AMP Learning Day 2019, taking place May 21st and 22nd in Calgary, Alberta. You can learn more at albertamentors.ca/learning. Now, over to Jane.
Awesome. Thank you. Hi, everyone. So as was mentioned, I'm Jane. I work at Brock University as their Knowledge Mobilization Officer. In my role, I work with our faculty members to create and maintain knowledge mobilization strategies for them. Let me just make sure this advances. There we go. So basically, I work to get our research in the hands of people that can use it. I also work a lot around ensuring that Brock's research is informed and co-created with relevant knowledge users. And finally, I work a lot around research partnerships with community organizations. So on that note, if anyone's interested in kind of connecting more with this project or the work that we do, just shoot me an email after the webinar and we can chat. I'm here today to chat with you about adolescent brain development and some of the interesting things that are going on during adolescence, specifically looking at something called the dual systems model of brain development, which I'll go into. And then I'll spend some of my time introducing a large research project here at Brock called the Brock Healthy Youth Project. We actually call it BHYPE for short. We have a full youth engagement committee that's involved in BHYPE. They've been meeting since year one of the project, which was before we got our grant. They named it, so we call it BHYPE because apparently that is the cool thing to call it. BHYPE is a longitudinal investigation of adolescent brain development and well-being. And then we'll finish off our time together looking at some of the future directions for this work and going over any questions that you might have. So why should any of this matter to you? There's actually some really interesting things going on during adolescence around brain development, and gaining an understanding of what's going on in teens' brains will actually shed some light on their behaviors and why they might be doing some of the things that they do. Basically, you're all individuals who work with youth on some level, and having an understanding of the cognitive underpinnings of adolescents' behaviors might actually help you work more cohesively with youth and design your outreach strategies and work that you do to meet youth where they are in terms of development. And you'll also get a chance to be involved in new research. BHYPE is strongly based in partnerships and the co-creation of knowledge with organizations and individuals and stakeholders. And we really want to work with people that have lived experience with youth and knowledge of youth outreach and youth research. So as I mentioned, after today, you can connect with me to learn more and be more involved in BHYPE as you'd like moving forward. So I'm going to be mentioning the terms adolescence and emerging adulthood today a couple times. So I just thought I would define those as they're kind of the age ranges we're chatting about today. So in terms of our work, when we talk about adolescence, we're really referring to the ages of 12 to 18. And emerging adulthood, in terms of what the research shows, it typically refers to the ages of 19 to 25, often being extended up until 29. And all of this typically can be put together under the term youth. So we're kind of looking at that large age range. And later on in the presentation, I'll go into exactly the age ranges that BHYPE is capturing. So the time period in our lives that we call adolescence or youth is widely seen as a time of growth and strength. When we hit our teenage years, we all experience rapid increases. For example, we get physically stronger, we have mental improvements. We typically are not yet experiencing any of the declines associated with adult aging, and we're getting over some of those vulnerabilities associated with childhood. Basically, our bodies are kind of getting to their peak. We're really hitting our stride. And overall, almost in every measurable domain, adolescence is a developmental period of strength and resilience. So things should be going pretty well. However, when we look at statistics, the overall morbidity, so that refers to the amount of injuries or diseases experienced, and mortality, which refers to the amount of death, these rates increase between 200 to 300% between early school age to late adolescence and early adulthood. So basically, this is a time of your life, at this time of your life, all of your capabilities are increasing and expanding without any of the drains that older adults may typically experience, yet the rate of disease and death are increasing dramatically during this developmental period. And this huge kind of increase in death and injury during adolescence is not because of things like cancer or heart disease. People typically are not getting sick. It's actually mostly attributable to injuries from preventable health risk and problem behaviors. What do I mean when I say health risk and problem behaviors? There's actually a bunch of maladaptive behaviors that tend to emerge during adolescence that may lead to these increases in injury and death. These type of behaviors tend to develop or are reinforced during adolescence and are the leading causes of injury for most youth. The biggest ones are sexual risk-taking, dangerous driving behaviors such as drinking and cell phone use. In fact, 40% of speeding drivers in fatal crashes are aged 16 to 24, and 40% of these drivers had also been drinking. And this image here is just from Parachute Canada, who works in injury prevention. That's where I used to work before I worked at Brock. And in terms of using a cell phone while driving, whether it's handheld or hands-free, it's actually been found to create risky driving behaviors similar to what having a blood alcohol content of 0.08 would, particularly among youth. Injuries from extreme sports and concussions can be heightened at this point. Binge drinking increases. In fact, 20% of high school students report frequent binge drinking. Sleep behaviors change a lot during adolescence. What we typically see is a lot of variability in sleep behaviors among youth. So your sleep patterning is all over the place, and this can really mess up your behaviors. In fact, when teens enter puberty, they undergo what it's typically referred to as a sleep phase delay. So teenagers' internal biological clocks actually shift forward, and they start having trouble falling asleep before 11 p.m. and waking up before 8 a.m., and this is just a natural delay that happens. And research has linked the lack of sleep among adolescents and teens to higher rates of chronic diseases like obesity, type 2 diabetes, more caffeine use, poor impulse control, lower levels of motivation, impaired attention, memory, and more. And this new science has actually led groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics to push for high schools to delay their start times so that students get more sleep each night. And I actually do know that some universities are also looking at this as well, because this sleep phase delay is also something that university students would experience during this time of their life. The sleep piece can also impact driving. It's been found that teen drivers who sleep less than 8 hours a night are 33.3% more likely to crash while driving than teen drivers who sleep at least 8 hours a night. Other behaviors that tend to emerge during adolescence, or what we call youth, are marked increase in suicide, experimentation, exposure to, and general use of alcohol, drugs, and vaping and nicotine, vaping being a big piece right now. Non-suicidal self-injurious behaviors, so what we commonly call NSSI. Unhealthy dieting and physical behaviors. In fact, it's been found that 80% of youth are insufficiently active. And we also see a lot around depression, with 70% of mental health problems having their onset between early adolescence and young adulthood. Now, before I go chatting into what might be going on behind these numbers and what might be causing the emergence of these injuries and problem behaviors among adolescents, I just want to quickly state that these are just stats, and not every youth that you meet is getting hurt or dying or running out and taking dangerous risks. In reality, most adolescents have little or no problems, but there are huge individual differences around their behaviors. What is true of adolescence is that it tends to be an age period with the onset of problem behaviors. So that's why we see that jump of mortality and morbidity rates when we reach this age range. Keeping in mind that these don't suddenly decline once they hit 30, and data actually do show that since the 1980s, there has been a decline in some health risk behaviors, particularly among adolescents. Again, this is expected because the world is changing for youth. We're now in school for extended period of times. We're putting off marriage and children up until much later in life. So overall, most adolescents and youth are doing okay. I don't want you to leave here today thinking that some person from Brock told you that all youth are dying. But something is clearly going on that makes adolescence a sensitive period. And while most youth will come out okay, it's really important for everyone to understand that youth are more at risk for risk-taking and problem behaviors than almost any other age range. So what's going on here? Well, it's fairly well known that early childhood, so those 0 to 3 age range, it's a really sensitive period for development, particularly in terms of brain development. And we know that what happens in those early kind of 0 to 3 ages is incredibly important for later health and well-being. However, more recently, the idea that adolescence might also be a sensitive period has gained traction. Research is beginning to show that adolescence might in fact be a second window of opportunity around brain development, and that this age might be a critical period for increasing our understanding about how these problems can be prevented. With all this resulting in unique vulnerabilities and opportunities for youth and for anyone that works with them. When talking about adolescent brain development, in the past, it was assumed that youth just have poorer reasoning and decision-making skills than adults, and this leads them to make poor choices around risk. So basically, it was assumed that adolescents and emerging adults didn't have the cognitive skills to reason and make decisions in risky situations, that they weren't mature enough yet to think rationally. However, research has actually shown that adolescents perform at or very near to adult levels and better than children when cognitively assessing the consequences of risk taking. In fact, there appears to be no problem among youth when they're asked to reason about risks. So there must be something else going on. One prominent theory in research is called the dual systems theory, or the imbalance model, which basically talks about two different areas of our brain and how they might develop and mature along different timelines. These two systems are called the social-emotional system and the cognitive control system. The socio-emotional system is the part of your brain that really motivates you to pursue exciting situations and rewards. It can be responsible for that kind of excited feeling that you get when you're taking risks or you're with peers and doing exciting things. Whereas the cognitive control system is the part of your brain that kind of restrains rash impulses. It's basically that little voice inside of your head saying, whoa, when you're about to do something or you're around people who are doing something risky or dangerous. So that social emotional system, it's part of what's called the limbic system of our brain, which again is really the part of our brain that draws us towards exciting situations and risky situations. It's really a reward area. And the dual systems or imbalance model basically posits that the limbic reward areas of our brain actually mature early. Research has in fact discovered that the parts of our brain involved in the social-emotional network tend to be fully active during adolescence, or even more active than adults. And this may be what intensifies adolescents' affinity for rewards in exciting, novel, and risky situations. On the other hand, our cognitive control system, which is part of our prefrontal cortex of our brain, so that front part, that's what's responsible for our thinking, our planning, our organization, our problem solving, and it's actually much slower to develop. So if you look at the graph on the screen, it shows the asynchronous developmental trajectories between these two areas, resulting in that middle area there, the risk phase during adolescence, when our limbic reward areas, they're more highly developed and functioning as compared to the prefrontal cortex. All of this kind of results in a perfect storm of sorts, where the imbalance between these two areas may make youth more inclined towards exciting, novel, and risky activities, without a fully developed cognitive control system in place to keep this in check. Basically, they're driving the car, but they don't have any brakes. What's even more complex is that this imbalance is thought to be more pronounced when there's heightened emotional arousal and when they're with peers. So not only are they driving without brakes, they could also have friends in the backseat egging them on. So this is obviously an interesting area to research. The problem with research on brain development is that it's really hard to do. First, it costs a lot of money, so you can usually only study a very small amount of people. And second, most research is done with surveys and in labs, which is problematic because in those situations, people tend to make decisions alone, in hypothetical situations, and under conditions of low arousal. In fact, in these type of situations, youth decision-making is often equal to adults, because without real-world influences, they can easily make decisions and use their cognitive control abilities. For example, in a lab or on a survey, a youth could easily kind of rationally use their cognitive control abilities to state drinking and driving is risky. However, that may not be how they would act in a real-world situation. And the reason for this is that in a lab environment, youth can use something called cold cognition, which is when they're in a sterile and non-exciting environment and their cognitive control abilities have time to kick in and bring reason into decision making. This is really problematic for research because in labs or on surveys, we might not be able to see what's really going on with youth brains and what they would do in real life situations, particularly because in the real world, outside of surveys and labs, adolescents and emerging adults typically make decisions in groups, in real situations, are often under control, under conditions of high arousal, and they have peer influence. In these types of real environments, this leads to something called hot cognition, which is the opposite of cold cognition. These real life environments are where the social emotional system can be firing fast and firing first. However, we do have a new research project here at Brock that's aiming to move past some of these barriers. As I mentioned, it's called the Brock Healthy Youth Project, or BHYPE for short. And we received $1.4 million from CIHR, which is one of the Tri-Council funding agencies, to examine this issue of adolescent brain development longitudinally. We had funding for 5 years, but we do have a plan to apply for further funding. And BHYPE is a collaboration between 18 researchers, 80 would be a bit much, 18 researchers, and we have national and international representation. We also have over 30 partner organizations, from the World Health Organization to UNICEF to Big Brothers Big Sisters of Canada. It's also just local people here in Niagara. And we also do have a youth engagement committee. And as I mentioned, they have been meeting about this project all the way from the beginning. And we actually go over pieces like our surveys with them so that we actually have a youth voice in the work that we're doing. And they are very committed to the project, which is awesome. So the purpose of BHYPE is to examine the following areas longitudinally. First, is there support for adolescence being a second window of opportunity for brain development in addition to early childhood? Two, how does that impact on vulnerabilities and opportunities for youth? And three, how does brain development interact with personality, activity involvement, physical health, mental health, environmental factors, etc., over time to affect health and lifestyle choices? As a whole, BHYPE aims to provide, first, an integrated investigation of the development of youth health risk behaviors. Two, evidence-based support, or lack thereof, for the dual systems model of adolescent brain development and its implications for youth vulnerabilities and opportunities. Three, updates on indicators for health and wellness throughout the transitions from childhood to adolescence to young adulthood that are best to target in prevention and intervention programs, such as activities that enhance impulse control and positive lifestyle choices. And we're working to link all of these back to United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Those are pieces that are coming out from some of the work that we're doing with our partners, so focusing on some co-creation there. And four, a timely and widespread application of findings given the strong team of researchers, partners, and integrated knowledge mobilization strategies. So what is BHYPE? So BHYPE is a longitudinal examination of 1,500 Niagara youth. In year one, they were in grades 3 to 8. Now, longitudinal is necessary to assess within individual change over time, so we can look at interactions with other systems, such as mental health and personality, again, over time, and the direction of effects over time. So we can see what is kind of coming first and what is influencing other, rather than knowing what kind of correlates. Where we are right now is that we're actually currently in the middle of year 3 in BHYPE, so our participants are currently in grades 4 to 10. And what happens is that every year, those 1,500 youth, they do 2 surveys, and they actually do these in class. So we've got some great relationships with some of our school boards. We go into each of our schools twice a year. We have time during class, and the youth doing the surveys do their surveys. The youth not doing their surveys participate in other wellness-focused activities. Then we also have a mobile lab component, and that's done with one-on-one with a smaller subset of our students, about 500 of the 1,500. What happens is these youth actually one-on-one, they'll go into the mobile lab, and we actually hook them up to an encephalo, I can never say it right, I typically just say EEG, which is basically a measure of their brain activity. They put on their little EEG cap, they do some tasks on a computer, and we're actually able to get full readouts of their brain activity, what's going on when they're doing different tasks. We also take physical characteristics such as body mass index. We do a full sleep assessment of these participants, so they wear what's called an actigraph, and they wear that for a week, and we can get full printouts of their sleep. We also do heart rate variability. We also collect their genetics and their hormones. We do that through spit samples, And again, this is another longitudinal component. So these youth are doing this several times throughout the 5 years. And we're doing that individually with them. And that's kind of an image of what our mobile lab looks like. It's actually literally a trailer with windows that goes from school to school during the winter months. We do move it inside. So we have sections of the school that are kind of cornered off for BHYPE in classrooms. And we turn that into kind of an inside mobile lab within the school. Some of the key topics that BHYPE is looking at is brain development and risk-taking, mental health, the benefits of club and sport involvement. And in this, we do include mentoring. So we do ask them on their surveys, what organizations are you involved in? Are you involved in Big Brothers, Big Sisters? So we do have all of that information. Risk-taking behaviors, the onset of depressive symptoms, health and physical information. We look at injuries, especially some information around concussions. Physical, social, and emotional well-being, bullying and aggression, and also academic achievement. But again, keep in mind we are doing two very big surveys every year, so this is just a snippet of what we're looking at. And one piece that I did forget to mention is that we also do have parent data as well. So we did do surveys with the parents and are continuing that. So there's overall a lot of information. For some of our early results, we do have infographics that we've put out. Those are right now just prevalence data. It's a wide breadth of data and topics. It does not right now include interactions and change over time. Our next next release of infographics will include some interactions, some change over time, some of our EEG results. We've also got some EEG results for what we were calling the peer project. And I'm also going to chat about called our social media study. That was a little study that we just put out that got a lot of media attention. So I just wanted to touch on that piece as well. And I'm going to go through all of these individually now. Looking at that first piece, which was infographics. So in late 2018, we released our first version of infographics. These are just meant to be kind of short, high-level snippets of some of what we're seeing. All of these, as I mentioned, all these infographics just contain prevalence data, but again, we're going to be updating them to include change over time, how behaviors may be changing each year. These are all available online. I'll also make sure to circulate them, and I've already given them out to Corey and Michael, so they should be there somewhere. And don't worry if you don't catch a lot of what I'm showing. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly just so you can see the topics, because again, I will send them out. Some of our topic areas, we did one just on general demographics. You can kind of see what our sample is looking at like. We've got one on activity engagement, and again, within here, we've got some mentoring activity that we've captured with them, and you'll see here that we do have a fair bit that are involved in activities. We've got some pieces on aggression, so this would be bullying-related behaviors, but just given in terms of research, we don't specifically ask about bullying. We're talking about aggression, so I've got that piece there. We have a lot of information on alcohol, drug, tobacco, and vape use. Importantly, we do have pre-post legalization cannabis data, so it's going to be interesting to see how some of their pieces and perceptions change around that. Beyond just general prevalence of are you doing this, are you drinking, are you smoking, are you using drugs, are you using a vape, we also ask them kind of their perceptions around it. So that middle piece there, we're asking whether or not they think it would be hard to say no to their friends to do something. And on the other side in the middle, we ask if they think it would be fun or not. So we see that overall, for example, 9% think it would be a little bit hard to say no if their friends asked them to smoke cigarettes, whereas only 4% think it would be fun to smoke cigarettes. So you can see that peer influence coming out there. They think it would be hard to say no, but they actually don't really want to do it. We've got information on family relationships, so their perceived relationships with their mother and father figure, whether or not they're talking with them, how they feel that interacts with their life and their behaviors. I mentioned we've got concussion-related data, so this one kind of talks about what we're seeing in terms of concussion. We've got stuff on nutrition and physical activity, so if they're doing sports, how often they're eating, what their food consumption looks like. We have a lot of information on their peer relationships, so their quality of friendships, whether or not they feel shy, if they feel shy with people they know well. We also have information on their romantic relationships as well. A lot of information on risk-taking. This is just a very, very small snippet. I just grabbed to do this a couple of the risk-taking behaviors that we talked with them about. We also have their perceptions of risk associated with specific behaviors. Something really interesting that came out here is that out of all the ones that we asked them about, alcohol, smoking marijuana, vaping, cigarettes, and other illegal drugs, out of all of them, they thought vaping was the least risky. So there's some interesting things we think going on with vaping as well. And an interesting piece there with vaping is we've actually used our youth engagement committee to help us with some of the language of how to phrase the vaping questions in our survey. Because me as a grown-up, I might ask, like, do you use a vape device? But I talked to my youth engagement committee and they said, no, we don't call it a vape device. We call it a vape. The stuff that we put in it, we call e-juice, and we're buying it from each other on Snapchat. So we're actually able to integrate that into our survey saying, okay, do you use a vape? Where do you get your products, e.g. vape juice? And add some of our options being like, do you purchase it through social media? Because that's what our youth engagement committee is telling us that they're doing. We have information on school and neighborhood perception, so whether or not they're missing school, how they feel about going to school. We have a lot of information around stress and well-being, so how often they feel good about themselves, are they feeling anxious, their frequency of worrying. We've got several scales around depression, some of their daily stressors. You'll see there that they actually know a noisy classroom was the biggest daily stressor that really often bothered our youth, with 42% stating that one. Then we also have information on time management. So how often they do these different activities. We do have this broken down between what they do over a weekend and what they do on a weeknight. Just for the utility of an infographic, making it easy to read, we combined those. We do have those broken down as well. In terms of interesting results beyond just kind of the prevalence data, we're in the middle of several studies right now. We're doing some pieces around how they feel about punishment in terms of peers, social anxiety. We've got some researchers looking at boredom, some sleep, the mental health piece. But I'll talk about one of our first ones, which is what we call the peer project. So the purpose of this was to see if there is dual support for the dual systems models hypothesis that adolescents are more likely than children to engage in risk-taking when being observed by a peer. And if so, is it related to greater sensitivity to rewards? And our procedure here, I can't go into too much detail, but basically we randomly assign children who are grades 4 to 5 and adolescents who we put as grades 6 plus to complete a computer game while doing EEG, while in our EEG, either while playing alone or while they were being observed by a peer. And the youth thinks that they're winning points while they're playing this game, and that corresponds to a prize that they actually will get. So they don't just think they're playing, they are literally playing this game to get points, and it corresponds to a prize. Alone, they think they're just going to get the prize. In the peer condition, it's them and the peer that will get the prize. So basically, we wanted to empirically test the dual systems model around adolescents being more likely to engage in risks with a peer, and does their brain activity actually show what's going on here? Do we see some differences between adolescents and children? I'm not going to show all of the kind of aggregated EEG brainwaves for this because I wasn't sure everyone's familiarity with that sort of data, and I didn't want to sit here having to explain a P3 over a webinar, which is not probably the best form of knowledge mobilization. So I just wanted to summarize basically what we're seeing at a high level. If you have more questions, please just send me an email because I promise I have more slides on this and I can go into more detail, but this is very high level. Basically what we found was that there were significant differences in their EEG, and keep in mind that's brain activity. So their brain activity responses for adolescents, but not for children. What we found was that everyone in general paid more attention to losses than wins, which we didn't expect at first. We thought that everyone would pay attention to the wins more. But when we looked in the literature, it's not really that surprising. If you think about it, it kind of makes sense. When you lose money, you just that feeling of, oh no, I lost, and you focus on it, versus when you win, that's great, I won, but the loss can really stick with you. The big piece is that the attention to losses was even stronger for adolescents when they were with peers. I can show the EEG, it's another time, but their EEG response when they're losses in front of peers is significantly different and just very clearly different with our results. So overall, adolescents do appear to be more sensitive to peer presence when making decisions than children, and this is being shown in their underlying unconscious cognitive behavior. It's not just that they're getting excited and they're doing it. Their unconscious behavior is showing that they are more sensitive to peer presence when they're making decisions. We teased that apart a little bit more. It seemed that half of adolescents seem to be worried about negative evaluation from their peers. Those are the ones that paid greatest attention to losses. and the other half seem to be excited, and they think it's fun when they're in risky situations with their peers. And now what we're doing is working to pull apart within those groups, what are the individual differences? Are some of them more socially anxious? Are some of them more risky than others? What's actually happening within those groups? But the big piece is that first, the results show that there is a peer effect among adolescents. And this, again, is empirical support. I imagine that a lot of you are thinking, well, of course, peers are important. But now we actually have some empirical evidence showing that unconsciously this is also affecting their brain activity. And the results support the suggestion that adolescence is a sensitive period for social influence as compared to childhood. So peers are becoming increasingly important, and peer influence may especially be impactful during situations with heightened arousal, like risk taking. So in general, we should be taking peers into account when creating and running any sort of outreach program for adolescents, and because this is literally something that unconsciously is impacting what they're choosing to do. The next study I wanted to chat with you about is our social media study. So as we all know, social media has become an important communication tool for youth to stay connected and socialize with their peers. This has prompted a lot of research interested in identifying how social media may affect today's youth. Some recent research has indicated that there may be an association between greater social media use and higher depressive symptoms among adolescents. This association has been interpreted as social media use leading to greater depression. However, to make this claim, longitudinal research investigating the same people over time is needed. We actually have two large longitudinal studies that allowed us to address this question more among adolescents and young adults. The first one being BHYPE, which we've chatted about. The other being a previous study called Stressed at Brock, which surveyed 1,100 first-year Brock University students annually over 7 years. And that's a recent sample as well. It only finished up a couple years ago, so it's recent information. And in both of these studies, we have annual self-report measures of well-being and reported average time spent engaged in social media, along with numerous other measures. But for this study, we were really looking at social media and well-being. And in both of our samples, we found that social media use did not predict greater depressive symptoms over time for males or females. Instead, greater depressive symptoms predicted more frequent social media use, and that was only among adolescent girls. This finding contrasts with the idea that people who use a lot of social media become more depressed over time. In fact, what our research shows is that perhaps adolescent girls who are feeling down may turn to social media to try to make themselves feel better. This finding highlights the importance of testing multiple different explanations for why a relationship might exist. We believe that this work is important for a wide range of audiences. When parents read media headlines such as Facebook depression, there's an inherent assumption that social media use leads to depression. Policymakers have also recently been debating ways to tackle the effects of social media use on mental health. And our social media study highlights that this fear of social media may be premature. Of course, we still need more longitudinal studies replicating our findings before any of this can become more definitive and more conclusions can be made. Around social media, in the future, we think it would be really beneficial to look into individual differences. There may be different groups of people who use social media for different reasons. For example, there may be a group of people who use social media to make social comparisons, who turn to it when they're feeling down. Another group of people may use it for more positive reasons, such as keeping in contact with friends. In addition, it would be really interesting to look at how the quality of social media use, for example, using social media for social comparisons versus active versus passive engagement, and the type of social media, how all those pieces might be associated with well-being over time. And again, that over time piece is really key to really get at the direction of effect between these relationships. So what's next with BHYPE? Big piece, additional knowledge mobilization. Really focus on co-creation with partners. That's a piece we're entering into right now. Producing some videos. You'll probably see some whiteboard videos coming out with our results moving forward. Media and social media, public and practitioner outreach initiatives. That's a big piece. We do 100% have data on involvement in mentoring activities. Again, like I mentioned, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And what we're going to be looking at next in some of our work is do we see this as maybe a protective factor? How can this, how can mentoring impact some of this over time? Where is the relationship going? Do youth that have certain individual differences tend to go towards mentoring more? And what does that relate to over time and other behaviors? How does this relate to navigating complex peer relationships? We know that adolescence is a sensitive time for peer influence. Does mentoring have any kind of mediating or moderating effect in there? In year three, we're going to be looking at more at change over time and additional EEG results. We've got three publications in the works. A bunch of our team is literally on a plane to Baltimore right now to present some of those. So you'll be seeing a lot more of that coming out. And then our big piece is that next year we'll be going for what's called a SHRC partnership grant. So we want to take this work that we're doing with BHYPE and expand it to a national level of partners working together to look at this idea of youth transitions together. Big Brothers Big Sisters will likely be involved in that. And again, we're looking at other organizations to be involved in that. So if that's something, if BHYPE, any of this aligns with what you're doing, so please make sure to connect with me. I know this is a really big slide, but I wanted to throw up some additional reading if people are interested in any of these stuff, because this a lot of this base research has been done by phenomenal researchers around the world. So I just wanted to throw up some pieces around different pieces that you can read, and I'll make sure these slides are available. And that is it for my presentation. So I think we've got some time for some questions.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. It's funny, in Alberta, there's been a whole series going on called Growing Up Digital, where the Alberta Teachers Association has brought some researchers in whose names I'm missing right now, but it's part of it's looking up the effects of digital technology, sleep deprivation, social media, etc. And there's some really interesting preliminary findings there that seem to somewhat be contradicted by the social media work that you found. So
we just put this out. We got a lot of media around it as well, because it is very contradictory, because a lot of research shows that other research was showing that there is an association. I think there's a whole group of people now, including BHYPE researchers, that are working together to try to tease apart these individual differences and direction of effect piece.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing the researcher said is, well, we do know that if you have your phone with you in bed, you're probably not sleeping. You're probably cutting down on sleep, exactly. Which leads to all these other mitigating factors. So whether it's because you're doing Words with Friends or because you're on Instagram, it's, you know, there's a number of different behavioral things that are impacted by social media that you're more likely to see decreases in sleep and other important building block behaviors.
Definitely. And we did not, we have all of, so for the sleep, they wear something called an actigraph, and we haven't correlated that our sleep piece with their social media. So that would be another interesting piece to do.
Interesting. We had a question here from Victoria, who asked, are you able to access data from the schools on things like suspensions, expulsions, absences, and special needs coding?
So the one thing that we do have from the schools is grades. So we've got their grades, and that's actually coming right from the school board. The parents consented to that on the consent form. We're working with Niagara Partners to see what other data we can get from other pieces, as we recognize the self-report piece is just a snapshot, even though we have the mobile lab piece. So that is in the works. We're also working with some of our partners to see how and if some of our participants are accessing resources outside of the school board. So in Niagara, we have something called Pathstone Mental Health, which is a mental health agency. So we're looking into some of that. All of that's going to involve some going back to the parents to make sure that we get some sub pieces of consent. We have great, great, great retention with BHYPE. They are staying. This is a club that we're in, but that's because we have such an open connection with our parents. So we're looking into that. So great question, Victoria. We are on it. It's just that it's a lot of different moving parts.
Another question I had is, so I know you're in conversation with Big Brothers Big Sisters of Canada, as well as other youth mentoring agencies. So for those of us on the webinar who are interested, naturally in my mind went to the impact of peers and the research that you're doing there. I would think that my hypothesis would be that you'll have some great data coming out of this about the roles of mentors or caring adults as positive role models. Has anything been explored around that?
We have the data. We're at a point now that we've got such a clean data set. We had to wait until we at least had some change over time. So for that piece, we have it, and it's something that we would look at. It's just, again, getting into it. Because if you keep in mind, we do an hour survey with them twice a year, 1,500 of them. But that is something that we're now moving into right now, that we're just about to finish year three. We'll get that in there. So we've got it all. It's just making sure that we actually get it out there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the impact of peers and positive peer groups was certainly, that was another thing that stuck out to me from your presentation. So certainly appreciate that. I guess from here, maybe being mindful of the time, where to from here? So I would love to have you back in 12 months and to say, where are we now, and to see what's coming up. But is there a better way you'd prefer that the Alberta community connects to your work?
A couple different pieces. I'd be happy to come back in a year. But what I also can do is just make sure to connect with, on the kind of front end, you guys, Corey and Michael, saying, here's what we have, pumping out when we've got new publications and pieces like that. Like when that social media thing came out, I could send you the media that we did about it, so you have it. When our infographics come out, which should be in the next couple months, sending those along. So I'll just, on my end, make sure to kind of add you to my big distribution list to send out what we have. And then you can circulate what you think is appropriate and relevant. And then definitely come back in a year to do another webinar to show where we're at and what's happening. And then also keep you guys informed around that SHRC partnership grant, because those dollars are really going to be meant to bring us together. So that would be an exciting piece to explore together.
Yeah, this is most interesting. And thank you again for sharing with us and taking the time. Seeing no further questions in the queue, I was wondering, actually, we do have one question just popped up. How do we get access to the slides? So Corey, what's our plan for distribution here? Are we able to email the presentation? And Jane, if you share the PowerPoint, are we able to share that with the audience?
Yeah, for sure. I'll get it. I'll clean up some of the little pieces in there, and I'll send it out when we're done.
Awesome. And then we'll pass it on to the registrants.
And that'll be included in the follow-up email that comes in about 2 days. And then the recording of this webinar as well will be included.
Well, thank you so much, Jane. Have a wonderful day. Thank you to everybody who's listening. Remember to go to albertamentors.ca, sign up for our newsletter, and I hope to see you at Learning Day in Calgary. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Please visit www.albertamentors.ca to see our resources, explore our content, and learn more about how you can expand and enhance your mentoring program. Please subscribe to our podcast on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcast. And please take a moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel so you can watch our webinars and take more of our great content back to your mentoring program. If you have a guest or a topic you would like covered on our show, please shoot us an email. We want to hear your mentoring challenges and celebrate your big wins. Reach out to us at mentor.support@albertamentors.ca